evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, September 7, 2020. 4 people are killed in a revenge attack in Lake State.
Some youths went to collect firewood where they met other armed youths and they were shot and one person was killed.
And some internally displaced persons in Jonglei State say they are living in fear.
People are moving from block to block because of fear. They abandoned their place.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Police in Lake State say 4 people were killed and 3 others wounded in 2 separate revenge attacks on Friday and Saturday. Lake State Police spokesperson Captain Elijah Mabor says dozens of armed young men laid road ambushes targeting both civilians and members of the South Sudan People's Defense Forces in Rumbek Central County. For VOA News, William Mabor reports from Rumbek.
Lake State Police spokesperson Captain Elijah Mabor Makwai told South Sudan in Focus Monday last week's violence was between armed youth from Athoi community in Rumbegis County and Panyuan community from Rumbek Central County. Makwai says a few days ago, cattle keepers from Athoi fled their flooded villages in Rumbek East and moved their cattle to Panyuan in Rumbek Central County in search of a dry grazing land. On Thursday, armed youth from Panyuan attacked youth from Athoi, killing one person, according to Makwach.
The group of Athoi decided to migrate from Toch because of the flood, and they come to the place called Makwanyam. That area fell under Panyuan section, and they camped there. Some youths went to collect firewood where they met other armed youths and they were shot and one person was killed. And the fighting escalated until at the end it has resulted into 3 people killed and 3 others wounded both sides.
On Friday, Makwai says armed authorities youth carried out a revenge attack on the Panyuan, killing 3 people and wounding 3 others. Makwai says the government dispatched forces to the area to stop the violence and convince leaders of both communities to range in their youth and bring the perpetrators to justice.
There was a group of 30 youths on Land Cruiser coming from Pachong. Upon arrival to at Chuaichuk, they fell in ambush, they were shot. But no one was harmed. And according to the information we received, we were told that this group which were traveling on a Land Cruiser were the one who provoked the local community. They were thinking aggressive thong to the people, against the people of that area. And again, on their coming back, they repeated the same. That's why angered the youth of that area.
Some Lake State residents are calling on the state authorities to carry out more campaigns to disarm civilians in order to stop the cycle of intercommunal attacks. Resident John Chich Dut says armed youth in Lake State are not ready to voluntarily hand over their guns. He says peaceful disarmament through local chiefs will not remove guns from the armed civilians bent on revenge.
As a youth, I have condemned what happened because the issue of revenge attack and killing people in town is not completely good. And we never seen turn up of the arms. There is no proper procedures from the chiefs who can even try to bring arms from the youth. Because youth are not even trying to give arms out.
Lake State authorities launched a voluntarily disarmament exercise on August 10th when armed civilians were asked to voluntarily hand over their guns to local chiefs who in turn hand over weapons to the state governor. 500 guns were collected during the first exercise. Fewer than 150 weapons have been collected in Rumbek Center and Rumbek East counties since that time. For VOA News, I am William Sande Mabor in Rumbek Lake State.
A committee appointed by President Salva Kiir to investigate a land dispute in Juba's Gumbo neighborhood, which left 6 civilians and a military officer dead, has asked the government to stop military officers from interfering into land matters. A minister in the office of the president says the committee also asked the government to organize a national land conference to review policies and laws governing land matters in South Sudan. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
Speaking to reporters during the release of the Shirkat incident report on Friday, Nial Deng Nial, the Minister for Presidential Affairs, says a land dispute between a civilian and an army officer, Lieutenant Colonel, triggered the violence in Shirkat.
Ajib Jomyor had obtained a sublease of a plot of land. On this plot, he erected a commercial public toilet. Lieutenant Colonel Lualako, now deceased, subsequently erected two rows of iron sheet shops next to a York's existing public toilet. The fence that Lieutenant Colonel Lualako constructed around his shops was extended to enclose part of the public toilet's driveway, reserved for sewage tanker trucks to occasionally empty the septic pit. And this practically made the toilet that was erected unusable.
York filed a complaint against Lieutenant Colonel Akook. An inspection found Akook's construction to be unauthorized, but Akook refused to cease construction or demolish his fence, according to Nial, all of which led to the deadly violence on June 3rd. Nial says the incident underscores the persistent involvement of military officials in land issues across the country. He says the committee has come up with a list of recommendations which the government will follow to resolve land disputes, including ordering authorities to work with local communities to ensure that citizens are able to access their land.
The government to direct the Peace Commission to organize a community dialogue, particularly in Shirkat, and organize a national land conference to review the policies and laws governing land matters. Sixth, the government to issue strict instructions to the military and other organized forces to stop their personnel from acting as chiefs and involving themselves in local government administration.
According to the 2009 South Sudan Land Act, land belongs to the people of South Sudan and its usage should be regulated by the government. For years, citizens of Central Equatoria State, especially those in Juba, have complained that powerful politicians and military officials often engage in land grabbing. Justice and Constitutional Affairs Minister Ruben Madul Arol, who headed the committee, says most land matters are handled outside the legal process, which he says is bound to lead to problems.
The other unfortunate thing was that the incident depicted an organized officer in the military forces of South Sudan against a civilian. And the organized officer had recruited soldiers from within the ranks of the military to be his personal guards and was using them for his own personal errand. And that resulted in the unfortunate situation of arms, guns being used to inflict damage against civilians.
Army spokesperson Major General Lu Raikong says army officials who acquire land illegally should be held accountable.
If there are individuals who are getting involved in land grabbing here and there, and then it should be settled by the relevant land authorities in the individual cases.
With the Shirkat incident report completed, Nial says all suspects accused in connection with the incident will now face trial. For VOA News, Amanyang David Mayar in Juba.
Some internally displaced persons living at a UN-run protection of civilian site in the jungle state capital Bor say they are living in fear after the United Nations mission in South Sudan withdrew its peacekeepers from the camp. A leader of the IDP says the withdrawal of the troops leaves 3,500 families in the camp vulnerable to attacks by armed criminals. The chief of the UN mission in South Sudan says he believes it's now safer for the IDPs to return to their homes.
UN withdrew its troops on 1 September at night. He didn't inform us. In the morning, we got it that so any protection of civilian or military protection inside the Bokiwochi.
People are moving from Bolog to Bolog because of fear. They abandoned their place.
That is Makwach Munkem, head of the IDPs in Bor, who says thousands of IDPs could be attacked and harassed by criminals because the camp is located outside of town. David Shearer is special representative of the UN Secretary General in South Sudan, said at a news conference in Juba on Friday that after careful planning, ANMIS had begun withdrawing its troops from Bor and Wau POCs.
There are no longer any of those uniformed forces inside those sites or in the guard towers around them. That has occurred because we assess that any threats that may have existed in the past are no longer in existence today. Importantly, withdrawing from these sites means that those troops who were occupied at the POCs can be redeployed to hotspots where people's lives are in immediate danger, like in Jonglei.
While the ANMIS chief says it is safe for the IDPs at Bor and Wau POC sites to return homes, Munkem says a unified force is needed to facilitate the safe return of IDPs as some of their homes are still being illegally occupied.
They say the POC should not be longer to be protected by the UNMIS, and they say also this one will be available to the government, and we have we government because we are on unity government, and the unity government is not yet completed. There is no deployment of unified force, and even the deployment is not complete.
Jonglei State Police Commissioner Major General Joseph Mayana Kon says ANMIS as yet to officially hand over protection of the IDP camps to the government.
I think there is no unofficial handing over. It was last week I was told that there is an arrangement that the IDPs are going to be resettled just near our police station there, Sokwang. So we were given a chance so that we come and sit down and then we talk for the way things are going to work. Okay, it's going to take over. That was not discussed.
Akon says if ANMIS wants Jonglei State authorities to take over the protection of the IDPs in its camps, it should make arrangements to do so in an official manner. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaideng in Bor.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, are you planning for your wedding during COVID-19? We have an answer for you right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
who do you listen to in difficult times and why?
Mostly I listen to my wife and my dad, because these two people, they know me better than anybody.
I listen most to my mom because she's been through a lot. She has a lot of experiences, and anytime I tell her something, she kind of has a solution to the problem.
The person to listen to in difficult times: one, your parents. Two, if you're married, then it should be your partner, because your partner is the person who is there with you every time.
In difficult times, I most of the time listen to my fiancé. When I speak to him, he gives me good advice that helps to calm me down.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linar Mudu. The World Health Organization and the Africa Centers for Disease Control say there are no drugs approved to fight COVID-19. If you have tested positive, Talk to a doctor before taking any medicines. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Marriage, in these socially distant times, even the ceremony itself can't always bring together couples and their families together. In Africa, some digitally savvy couples are finding virtual workarounds to get them to the altar, including wedding where the bride and the groom are thousands of kilometers apart. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to one African couple who solidified their bond while in two different countries and brings us this story of love, longing and celebrations from Johannesburg.
Fifi and Emmanuel Agwebu got married last month. But in these difficult times of coronavirus restrictions on travel, they resorted to a modern solution. They did it virtually. She was in Nigeria's southeastern Enugu state, dancing herself down the aisle for their traditional Nigerian wedding. And he was in Johannesburg, South Africa's economic hub, where he works as a musician, watching it all online. The bride says her special day was no less special despite the absence of the groom.
On that day, he was like online and we were talking every second. So I didn't feel like he wasn't around. I actually felt he was with me, like he was with me, really. Just that he wasn't there present, you know. So it was just, I'm sure people will be wondering, why is this girl dancing and laughing and having fun? I just felt he was there, really. Like, it wasn't any different to me, really. So I didn't feel indifferent. I felt good.
Agwebu notes that a close friend of hers did the same recently, virtually marrying with the groom in England and the bride in Nigeria. They're among the countless couples across the world kept apart by the pandemic. But even those who are together can't celebrate in a traditional way because of pandemic restrictions on large crowds. It's crashed the business of Johannesburg party supplier Malebohang Gulwako. She supplies weddings and engagement parties with champagne walls, transparent shelves of filled glasses in front of an ornate wall. Gulwako, herself a newlywed, says it may take some cultures on this side of the world a while to accept virtual celebrations.
It's going to take a very long time, whereas, because remember, we also grew up in big families. We always had people, at least a minimum of 7 people around you for your 7th, 8th, 15th, and 21st birthday and so forth. So it's going to be very hard to unlearn celebrating on your own. I'm not sure about the Western culture because maybe you can just do a dinner with like one other person and that's okay. But that's not us. That's not me.
While some couples are delaying their weddings until COVID-19 restrictions are lifted, the Agwebus didn't want to wait to declare their love and commitment.
I felt bad that I couldn't make it there in person. At the same time, when I saw her dance, happily smiling, kind of gave me confidence, all the confidence I needed, and like, okay, she's happy. So at least that's something to hold on to.
The Agwebus plan to reunite in South Africa when flights resume. For now, these two, and countless others, will have to have and hold each other virtually. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The Universal Postal Union and the International Civil Aviation Organization are urging governments to provide postal, air cargo and express mail operators with the money and flexibility necessary to meet the challenges posed by the COVID-19 pandemic. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Postal services depend upon passenger planes flying and delivering the mail to people around the world. The pandemic has upended this system. Many governments have grounded or seriously limited air travel to prevent the deadly coronavirus from spreading to their countries. This is causing delays in the delivery of the mail. Spokesman for the Universal Postal Union, David Dadge, tells VOA the Post has reacted by creating new shipping, trucking, and train routes to deal with this crisis.
What ICAO and UPU are actually saying is if you want to return to the kind of quick deliveries that we were providing before, we need to get the system up and running again, and governments need to throw themselves behind the idea of trying to get things moving again.
Dutch denies that the viability of the international postal network is under threat from competition by private companies who have stepped in to pick up the lag.
But to be honest, and the figure is quite stark, the private companies are probably delivering around 70% of the parcels and the postal operators around 30%. So, you know, in essence, the world is changing and postal operators also need to move with the times.
Dutch says the industry has been changing its strategy quickly and dramatically to deliver the medical and humanitarian supplies needed to fight the pandemic. He says the post is no longer just about physical delivery of the mail. He notes many of the services it offers are conducted over the internet.
And I think what you will find from the pandemic is that this transformation and this movement to the digital, the movement to the internet, will be very much the way that the post defines itself as we go further into the 21st century. It's no longer about mail. It's more about parcels. It's more about financial services. It's more about business.
While private services offer stiff competition, Dutch says it is doubtful that they would wish to deliver the post to people living in isolated, remote areas. He says that would not be financially profitable. A unique feature of the universal postal system, he says, is the mail is delivered to everybody, rich and poor alike, all over the world, at a cost that is affordable. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Protesters in Portland, U.S. threw firebombs at police on Friday night, injuring at least one person, according to police. It was on the 100th day of demonstrations in the Oregon city over racial injustice and police brutality. Video of a black man choking to death in police custody in the city of Rochester, New York, has sparked renewed protest in cities across the nation against police brutality. VOA's Jason Patinkin has the story with reporting from Associated Press.
I'm already in. Drag and kill me! And Jesus, get out of here! My mom was moving over like right here, man! No, God! I need it!
That's the sound of 41-year-old black man Daniel Prude choking in police custody in March of this year. It comes from a video showing Prude handcuffed by police with a bag over his head. Police had found Prude, who had been suffering from mental episodes, running naked through the streets. They put a hood over his head and pressed his face into the pavement until he stopped breathing, despite his pleas to stop. A medical examiner concluded that Prude's death was a homicide caused by, quote, complications of asphyxia in the setting of physical restraint, end quote. The report lists excited delirium and acute PCP intoxication as contributing factors. Prude's case did not receive widespread attention until this week when his family obtained the video from police and released it to the public. Now, his name adds to the long list of black people who have been killed by American police officers. Prude's daughter, Tashira Prude, accuses police of covering up the real cause of her father's death.
I believe wholeheartedly that there was a cover-up because if my father died March 30th, there's no reason why this story is just now hitting the media. I don't understand how anybody could say or feel like he was a threat to the police when he complied with all orders. I feel like this case was simply just a case of police brutality and racism.
Police have said they put the hood over Prude's head because he was spitting and vomiting, and they were afraid of contracting COVID-19. Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren said she saw the video on August 4th, but she didn't suspend the officers involved until a month later, after the video went public. The officers have not been arrested and continue to be paid. Warren accused the city's police chief of falsely portraying the death as a drug overdose.
Experiencing and ultimately dying from a drug overdose in police custody, as I was told by the chief, is entirely different than what I ultimately witnessed on the video provided to me by the law department on August 4th. What I saw in that video was a man who needed help. Our response to to him was wrong.
A police internal affairs investigation in April cleared the officers involved of any wrongdoing. The report said that their, quote, actions and conduct displayed when dealing with Prude appear to be appropriate and consistent with their training, end quote. However, New York's attorney general on Saturday moved to form a grand jury to investigate Prude's death. Here's Rochester Police Chief LaRon Singletary.
First and foremost, I extend my condolences to the Prude family, and we want to make sure that Mr. Prude's death changes how we do policing in this city. Moving forward, we are dedicated to taking the necessary actions to prevent this from ever happening again.
Michael Mazzeo is the head of Rochester's police union, which calls itself the Locust Club. He called the mayor's statements irresponsible. Mazzeo also defended the officers involved in Prude's death, saying that they had followed their training.
Exactly what they were trained on, exactly what that training module is a step-by-step example, right to the second, on what these officers did on that scene.
But Mark Claxton, director of the Black Law Enforcement Alliance, said there needs to be a national standard for how police restrain suspects.
Well, quite clearly, there's a desperate need for policing, for law enforcement community to establish a clear, concise, common sense national standards about the apprehension of individuals and the dangers and risks that come along with any kind of neck restraint. Because too many individuals are dying, and let's be frank and honest about that, these individuals tend to be black and brown.
But Prude's daughter, Tashira, says police should not have been involved at all in her father's situation.
The people who were put on the streets to protect and serve did not protect and serve. When this incident occurred, my father should have been met with a mental health specialist. He should not have been killed in the street. He did not deserve that. He was treated like an animal.
Police have arrested at least 11 people during the protests in Rochester. With reporting from the Associated Press, I'm Jason Patinkin for VOA News in Washington.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song My Country by Lonely Boy.
Na na na, we back again. Lonely boy, the master, we back again. And I'm the security to look Sudan. I am a team to look Sudan. My country to look Sudan. Dana Skulum to look Sudan. And I'm the security to look Sudan. I am a team to look Sudan. My country to look Sudan. Dana Skulum to look Sudan. And I'm a replay. Nasketir ma biru du beleto mon bi haliso kaman di city mo malu you know Sudan de beleta masakila ko kebelia fogo kaman dia fogo mi malis papa kita kan rua bi beleta zo kene tariza asanta binu risala de Kedem wasulu le kulu junubin, kedem on hare, bele ku bele takim. I'm lonely boy, BMC music, oh na na, no no no. Anabize kiri, Junub Sudan, I am a team, Junub Sudan, my country, Junub Sudan, Danas Kulum, Junub Sudan, Anabize kiri, Junub Sudan, I am a team, Junub Sudan, my country, Junub Sudan, Danas Kulum, Junub Sudan,
Pule Bakuruke,
Aina,
Dolong Bakaruke,
Aina,
Dog Bagye Junior,
Aina,
Nandi Pondi Luke,
Aina,
Nandi Sepa Magi.
Aina na
ni se baka kwa
aina na
ni se bakuku
aina na
lakindo popuru
aina na
ni se bamadi
aina na
ni se baka kwa
aina na
ni se bakuku
aina na
lakindo popuru
ana bizekiri Junub Sudan.
We've been listening to Lonely Boy with the song My Country. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for taking your time to listen to this program. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers, because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Mama, Baba, ooh, ooh, no, no, no,
kanyo, domo kanyo, gore nyani jule.
Don't need no wetness somebody.